Well, here's what critics say about the great American novelist Richard Ford, one of America's preeminent men of letters. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author dazzles with yet another masterful work. He's seen these days as in the same company as Steinbeck and Stegner, Updike and Roth, and you wonder how the man can write another word with comparisons like that. Richard Ford's latest book, Canada, is out in paperback, and here's the really good news. He'll be in town this week to speak on Thursday night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Richard Ford is the author of The Sports Writer and Independence Day. Richard Ford, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you.
It's nice to get to talk to you, Steve. Thank you.
How do you continue to write when people are comparing you to John Steinbeck and Wallace Stegner? How do you react to that?
Well, I just think those guys are really good writers. That mostly when anybody compares anybody to anybody, because it's just kind of reflexive when you do that. You don't want to actually take on the writer himself, so you compare him to somebody else. I just think about what good writers those guys were, and Wally Stegner and Steinbeck. Even Steinbeck once in a while wrote a great novel. He didn't actually think he was a particularly good novelist, and he was better than he thought he was. So you try to, I guess, to answer your question directly, you just try to humanize those kinds of comparisons, because work to work, the comparisons aren't worth very much. And so you think to yourself, well, those are human beings. I'm a human being. That's about as far as it needs to go.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because does it put any pressure on you?
No. Goodness, no.
No.
And, you know, the truth is, Steve, good work is only ever encouraging. I don't have to do badly if my friend succeeds, or I don't have to succeed and therefore my friend do badly. So art is not a competitive sport, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, this probably isn't fair, but do you buy these comparisons? I mean, do you think that at this point in your career, you're in the same company as writers like that?
Well, we all write in English. We all write for the page. We're all looking for readers. They're still looking for readers, although they're gone now.
Mm-hmm.
You try to find the points of comparison that are the least invidious, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But it isn't paralyzing, not the least bit paralyzing. No. And plus, if you live where I live, mostly in Maine, you don't hear those things. I don't read reviews, and I don't listen to my recordings on the radio and things like that. I just try to stay home.
You know, there are a few memories that everyone has in their lives that sort of stay with them forever. And one of mine is being at Stanford back in the early 90s. And just before he died, Wallace Stegner came and spoke to my seminar group. And
great.
Oh, he began to read a story, Richard, titled Going to Town. I still remember the title of the short story. And it was sort of like a Robert Frost moment at John F. Kennedy's inauguration, because at that point in his life, Stegner's eyesight was failing. And he started reading the story, and then he put the book down. He says, you know, I can't really read that well anymore. And he just recited, almost verbatim, the rest of the story. And it was just magical. Just one of those moments, you know.
Well, I'm glad you had that moment.
Yeah.
You know, as you say, it's certainly true. We are, if we're lucky, have moments like that live in our memory, and then in some way further ennoble the acts of literature that we care so much about.
Yeah. You know, when you're looking for inspiration, Richard, what books do you turn to? If you need a kick in the pants, where do you go?
Well, it's pretty unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
When I was writing Canada, I would sometimes read my friend Blake Morrison's book, when was the last time you saw your father, which is about it's a memoir, really, and he's English, and so we didn't have any of the same idiom. But there was a way in which Blake's book achieved a kind of on-the-page intelligence, a sort of directness that I liked a lot. And so when I would sit down every morning, and if I felt sort of flat-footed, I would read a page of Blake's book, and it would just sort of remind me of what I thought great literature was. You know, I'm writing stories these days. One I just finished is in the voice of a character that I've written about before, named Frank Bascom. And what I do for that is I look at my own book.
Hmm.
I look at my own sort of times in my life when I've written about Frank Bascom. So you're just looking for something to get you off that dime, whatever that dime is, that's kind of got you sitting flat-footed, paralyzed slightly in the morning. That happens a lot, but there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing unusual about it.
We're visiting with the novelist Richard Ford. He'll speak at 6:30 Thursday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. You can grab a seat by RSVPing at kclibrary.org. There's a story about a Q&A with you in the Star today here in Kansas City, Richard. And one of your comments was that when you write out of fear of failure, and I'm wondering at this point in your career, is that really still the case?
Well, sure. I mean, you're whatever your past is, if you have past achievements, whatever they might be, they don't really help you write the next book that you write. Everything gets its own new project, and so everything is at risk of that sort of precipice feeling of possibly, you know, stopping or quitting existing. So sure, but that was mostly about when I was young. When I started writing, I had been in law school and I'd been in the Marines. I'd done a bunch of things, and none of them had worked out very well. So that when I turned to writing, sort of like looking at a blank wall and seeing a window open up, I really thought this is your last chance. If you don't make a go of this, and I was 23 years old, I thought I was old. Of course, 69 now, so I was not old at 23. Mm-hmm. But I just thought you cannot afford to have this not at least occupy happily a few years of your life.
You know, when critics talk about you, almost always they cite your economy with words, your ability to craft sentences that one critic wrote of your latest book, Canada, elevate the humdrum. You know, tell me that the writing comes more easily to you now after so many years of doing it and the 10 books you've done. Am I right or not?
Well, I don't. You know, the truth is, Steve, writing is not hard to do. I mean, you're indoors when you're doing it, mm-hmm. and you're mostly sitting down, and you're dealing with language, which in my case I like to do. I would never say that any of it has ever been hard. There are times in the life of a book or the life of one's efforts when things get a little more challenging than others, but you would never call it hard because, you know, you don't have to do it. You choose to do it. So I would never complain about it. It takes my full self, and I guess anything that you do, that you choose to do, that manages to occupy your full self, is pleasurable fundamentally.
When it gets challenging, like you just described, Richard, what do you do? How do you deal with that?
Keep on.
Mm-hmm.
Keep on. I mean, that's all you can do. There's nobody you can run outside and ask for help. Everybody I know who's a writer is too busy doing what she or he is doing, and so you can't ask them for help. I occasionally will ask Christina, my wife, if she would read something for me and tell me what she thinks about it, hoping that she'll say something that will just sort of create a little fissure in what I'm doing and let me get inside that fissure. But mostly you just have to go on being there. Mm-hmm. And that's all right. That's what you're there for. It's not as if you have to, you know, fly around the world. You're right there where it's supposed to happen anyway.
Hmm. Do you force yourself to write so many hours a day like so many writers do?
No. No, I don't. I work as long as I want to, and then I stop. And then usually that's four hours or so in the morning, and then I usually come back in the afternoon for an hour and a half or so. You know, there's no reason if I'm going to do this kind of job that I should work lawyers' hours. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not making lawyers pay.
Mm-hmm.
So and I went to law school, so I knew in Washington University, I knew what that was going to be, and it just didn't seem like anything I was cut out for. So no, I don't have to force myself at this late stage in life. No, I kind of run to my desk in the mornings.
Really?
Yeah, because that's, you know, a lot of any writer's life is spent not writing. It's spent doing 100 other things. You are lucky when you get to your desk, and so I try to start off every day at my desk and stay there as long as I can. It's a pleasure to get to do the thing you say you're doing, to get to be the thing you say you are.
You know, Richard, you said, you mentioned that you live in Maine. What does your writing den look like? Can you describe it to us?
Oh, it's wonderful. I converted a boat shed right down by the Atlantic Ocean,
wow.
And by which I mean I just had some insulation blown in and some interior walls put up, and I'm right there by the I'm right there by the sea. I don't have any, you know, it's an old, as I say, it's an old boat shed. It has all the scarrings and stainings of an old boat shed, an old main boat shed. And there's no telephone there. There's no music. There's no internet. There's no nothing. It's just me and it, and it's very quiet. I don't have windows that look out onto the ocean except little tiny ones, which I don't use. So for me, it's sort of ideal because I don't want to be sitting in my room mooning out the window. I want to be sitting in my room trying to dream something up.
Oh, that's just terrific. Again, our guest, Richard Ford, the great novelist. Your latest book, Canada, Richard, is a coming-of-age story about a 15-year-old boy who must find his own way through bank robberies and a kidnapping and abandonment and murder. This was your first book in 6 years. Was that a sign that you struggled with it or that you just took a break after your last one?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think, Steve, 6 years between books is very long. I mean,
no.
I think about my average. I mean, there are people who can do it faster. John Updike could do it faster. Joyce Carol Oates can do it faster. I just kind of try to make it be part of my life. And so it's more of a vocation than it is a career. And no, I don't think I struggled with this book. There was one part of the book that kind of stopped me dead in my tracks, and I just sat at my desk for a month, and then I walked around my desk for another month, and I finally came back and said, "Well, I have to do this." Don't ask me what it is, so I won't tell you.
You won't tell me which part of the book it was?
No, of course
you're not. You're taking my next question. Yeah, yeah.
I'm answering it in a different way.
How did you get onto this idea of, you know, how a kid, a 15-year-old kid, would be affected by parents who were bank robbers, Richard? That's such a funny idea.
Well, funny, not ha-ha, I think.
Right, right.
The book started with me being sort of captivated by the idea of a 15-year-old boy being transported across the border from Montana to Saskatchewan in 1960 against his will. It was just a little isolated event in my notebook. Nothing like that had ever happened to me. But I started thinking backwards then. Well, what would have had to happen to this boy that he would be in such a strait? And I thought, well, what could his parents have done? What would make it possible for them not to take him themselves? And then I just started going through my little memory bank of things that interested me, and bank robbery has always interested me.
Why not? You know, why not?
Why not? I mean, any writer, I think, would love to get to describe a bank robbery from the inside. And so that was very attractive to me to get to do that. And I found that it was engrossing to do that. There you are in a kind of rare instance for a novelist, sort of channeling the character and channeling yourself into the character as he sort of goes
great.
And, you know, cases the bank and so forth.
You also write in Canada that the parents that we're talking about here were the least likely people on the planet to be bank robbers to begin with. Why did you make them out to be that way?
Well, because I wanted them to be loving parents first.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought that probably everybody who robs a bank is a parent, or could be a parent. Not everybody could be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And probably that most people, this is after long thinking about it, most people who rob banks are inept. Most people who rob banks have not made a career of it. They do it as an act of complete desperation and despair. And so it just followed on that for these people to do that would make them almost unbearably unlikely.
Hmm. You know, a lot of folks, you know, so many critics make such a big deal about the first sentences of your novels. And in Canada, those lines are this, and the book begins this way. First, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murder, which happened later. Which, of course, you know, you read that, and of course you want to know the rest of the damn story, Richard. I mean,
and that's pretty good, isn't it?
It's very good. And was that a struggle to come up with those first lines, or did it just glide right out there?
They did not glide right out there, Steve. I somebody once asked me that question, and I said, well, you know, strange to say, those are the first things I wrote. And my wife was in the room. She started shaking her head. And I looked at her, she said, she mouthed to me silently, "No, it wasn't." So then later on when I said, well, what did I do then? Because these things tend to disappear out of my memory. She said, "You slaved over it for about a month." So that's what I did. But it was probably slating over some little niggling turn of phrase or getting one adjective out of a sentence. It probably at the beginning wasn't radically different from how it came out.
Well, I just love that. First, comma, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murder, comma, which happened later. I mean, there you go. Kabing. Kabing, kaboom.
Some people have said, why do you give it away like that? And I said, well, I give it away like that, and then I take it back because I don't tell you all that happened about it. I used it as a kind of an old-fashioned narrative hook, I thought.
Yeah.
It seemed to me to be particularly experimental as a way to start a book.
Richard Ford is our guest. I mean, the other obvious question about Canada, Richard, is your protagonist is just 15 years old. Why take on that challenge? Why not depict someone closer to your own age?
Well, who would want to read about somebody who's 69 years old?
But I would.
I can't imagine anybody wanting to read about that. Fiction is your rescue there, actually, to be able to project yourself out of however old you are and try to inhabit the life of another whose days are just commencing and whose life is all in front of him and whose challenges are quite vivid and whose dilemmas are quite profound. I don't know. It just seemed to be natural.
I mean, I could write a – I know 55 where I am in my life. I don't know my 15 anymore. I mean, that's too many years ago. I just have the sketchiest of memories of 15 and what I was doing and what I was thinking.
Well, it just may be the difference in you and me, and it may just be that I think that that's my job description, that if I'm going to write about somebody who is not myself, I'm going to have to make that plausible. And so maybe that's just one of the sort of, I wouldn't want to say magical, but otherwise parts of creating a character who is not you.
Did you go hang with 15-year-olds? Did you do that whole thing?
I think you can get in trouble doing that.
And who needs that, right?
No, I did not hang with 15-year-olds, nor am I going to. I mean, my 15-year-old is the narrator of a novel. Mm-hmm. He's not your typical 15-year-old. I wouldn't mind hanging out with a 15-year-old who could narrate a very sophisticated novel. But to hang out with a 15-year-old who was just your typical 15-year-old, I think I'd find something else to do.
Plus the time, the setting, the time sequence is so different. They're just completely different times and places, yeah.
1960, yeah, from now, sure. Almost amazingly different, because in the process of writing the book, I was around that age myself in 1960. I sort of looked back at things that I knew, and I looked at newspapers from the time. It's a very long time ago.
Yeah. You once said, Richard, that readers are looking for an excuse to stop reading. Why did you say that? And so what does that do to the challenge that's sort of set out before you?
Well, you know, Henry James says that one of the things, maybe the most important thing a novelist has to do is to amuse the reader. And by amuse, he didn't mean put a smile on the reader's face. He meant by dint of felicity and intensity to keep the reader interested. So that's sort of all that I cared about, really.
Is that challenge greater today than it was 25 years ago?
It's the same. It's really the same. I mean, if I'm going to write another book, it's probably going to be another book that's going to draw on completely different resources from the ones I drew on. And so they will be as unusual to me, as alien to me, as challenging to me as were the first. I mean, I think it's the very same challenge. It's the delight, actually, of trying to find a way to give the reader something that the reader will find indispensable and new and useful.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope readers leave with once they've finished reading Canada, Richard?
I hope that they read to the last word, Steve. And if they read to the last word, then they would have discharged their contract with me. that's my goal. My goal is to get you from word one to word the last. And if I can do that, anything that you think about it, you will have earned. And even if it's not what I want you to think, even if it's what you and you only think, that's all right with me. I want to treat you to everything I've done, get you to the end, and then I would have done my job. I will have succeeded.
Richard Ford again speaks at 6:30 on Thursday evening at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza Branch. You can grab a seat by going to kclibrary.org. Richard Ford, it's just been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for taking
some
time with us.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad to get to talk to you, Steve.
We'll look forward to seeing you in a couple nights.
Thanks a lot.
That's Richard Ford. Again, his latest book is titled Canada, and it's just an absolutely terrific book.